You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington. Today is Monday, April 20th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the poet Rowan Klosnick. Born in Johannesburg, South Africa, Rowan Klosnick spent most of his life in Dallas, Texas, and now lives mainly in Mexico with his wife, Edith, dogs, birds, and turtles. Rowan's poems have appeared in numerous literary journals. Just a few include the Mississippi Review, the North American Review, Mi Poesias, and The Exquisite Corpse. His first full-length collection, Holy Land, was published last year by Black Ocean. An e-chapbook, Ringing, was released in March from Kitchen Press, and another chapbook, Dreaming, is due out this summer. Rowan holds an MFA in poetry from Vermont College. The poet David Rivard has said that Klosnick is ferocious in his humor and anguished intelligence and bad attitudes. Michael Martone said of Klosnick's poems, "Instead of introducing us to new words, they make the old words new again. Even the periods sing, read in earnest and for the first time." I spoke to Rowan by phone last week. I began by asking him to talk a little bit about his background.
I was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, and then grew up there. Around my bar mitzvah, I moved to Dallas, Texas, where except for college, I stayed till about 5-6 years ago, and I've been, most of the time, except for traveling, most of the time I've been down in Mexico since then. So, yeah, a little bit of variety there.
How has that influenced your poetry, do you think, having been from Johannesburg and now living in Mexico?
Well, I do travel a lot, too. So besides the changes, besides the places I've lived, I do like to change things up a lot, which is good, I think, for my poetry. Some people, you know, like their writing schedule to be pretty rigid. They write at the same time, every day, same place. And I do some of that, but for them, I like being able to move around and having different experiences.
Yeah. How would you describe your poetry, Ron?
The best way, I guess, to describe it is when the first time I read, besides at school, you know, when my book first came out, I think I began the reading by saying, you know, "Hi, I'm Rowan Klosnick. My themes are sex, death, violence, God."
That about covers
it. Yeah, as far as themes, yeah. I mean, as far as style of the way the poetry is written, they're written in prose. It's, you know, pretty direct, you know, sometimes even conversational language or style. It's not tricky or highly poetic or difficult or abstract, I don't think. It's fairly straightforward, maybe surreal at times, but pretty straightforward in its style. But, you know, sex, death, violence, God, as far as the themes and the content, I suppose.
Yeah. Have you ever played around with other forms other than prose poetry? Have you ever worked in more formalized ways?
Not too much more formalized, but I did write primarily, almost entirely in the beginning, in line broken verse and free verse. And I think there was a bit of a breakthrough for me when I discovered the prose poem form. It seemed to be more of my natural voice, or a voice that suited me anyway. I mean, a voice is kind of a mask anyway, but I seemed to be able to say more of the things I wanted to say and had more depth than what I was doing in free verse, which I felt was limiting what I was saying and how I was saying it. So once I kind of arrived at prose poem form, and, you know, after a while and kind of getting it down a bit and learning it, I felt like it was letting me do a lot more, so I was happy to arrive there, so I suppose.
How would you like readers to respond to your work? What are you hoping that they take away from it?
You know, readers are going to respond the way they do respond. You know, I would hope that my poetry, you know, is a little bit aggressive or intense. It's, you know, graphic and profane at some point. So I would hope that readers would, you know, give the poetry a chance and not you know, just have a knee-jerk reaction and abandon it because it makes them feel uncomfortable, or, you know, certain words are just like, you know, taking a bite of a bad type of food for some people. So you'd hope they get past that and look at the stuff and ask if it's still art and if it's still effective and beautiful in deeper and other ways. You would hope for that chance, but some people aren't going to do that, and that's been fine for me. So I hope people give writing a chance as I give any other writer a chance.
Right. When I was first reading your poems, I did find them very intense, very aggressive, like you say, but I think, too, that I kept thinking about them afterward, and I think that can be a sign of success in a poem, even if it's at first a little bit of surprise, even offensive, you know, for you to continue thinking about the themes afterwards. I think that's sort of important.
Yeah, if you're wording that, then it is successful. You know, it's easy to shock people and to just, you know, throw bad words into poems and violence, you know, almost gratuitously. It's not hard to do that, and you'll also make an impression on the reader. So you do want the poetry to be thoughtful and to be more than just that. So that's kind of a danger that you can slip into when you're writing the sort of poems that I'm writing, or, you know, when you're working with the same sort of feelings that I have, I guess.
Right. Well, and I think, too, what's interesting in your poetry is not just the ideas and the words that are in there, but the things that you put together, the ideas and the images that you actually choose to set side by side. That seems very interesting to me.
Are you talking about within individual poems or between poems themselves?
Well, within individual poems, but also there are themes that do run through the poems in the collection, aren't there? So that as well. But I was specifically talking about the within individual poems. Sometimes you'll see one theme or one image that in particular comes up against another image in that poem and is just very interesting.
And the poems aren't sort of randomly generated or randomly finished off. I mean, I do use some sort of random or sort of shuffle procedures to sort of generate initial content, but, you know, my poems go through lots of drafts, and I really do try to think them through carefully. I want them to feel as though they've just been sort of written straight or directly, but, you know, you can't just sort of do that.
Right.
It takes a little more work to make them feel natural or straight up. So, yeah. But
I'm wondering if this is a good time to ask you to read a couple of poems, just so that our conversation has something that we're bouncing off of here a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I've got some in front of me. Probably one from the book itself. I've other ones if you want me to later, but I could read a poem or two from the book.
Sure. Why don't we start with poems from Holy Land? And I'll just mention that this is Ron Klosnick reading from Holy Land, which was published by Black Ocean.
All right. I'll read the first poem in the book. There's some, you know, epigraph, whatever the word is, poems maybe that precede it. But the first poem in the book is essentially the following. And then maybe I'll read another one or two after that because they're short. There's a child in a ditch by the side of the road. She's the source of every drop of blood. Shadows, knives, machetes, angels sharpening the horns of beasts you'll never see. Over the long, dazzling fields they come. One small piece of time, chained to the next, howling and deep. They stomp and they spit. You belong to them. All right, that was the first one. And then maybe the first poem of the second section, I think, is the following. A needle hits and a whale gets roped. Eyes bulging, jerked back to dirt. Sharks go at my body, but lightning holds me together, and a girl with long gray fingers rubs my chest as she stares out to sea. The sky's trying to speak. Rocks and trees all bent in heat.
Thank you very
Another
much.
Another one or two? Or?
Sure. Well, let's start there. Let's talk a little bit about even just your first poem in the collection, which I think sort of speaks to my point a minute ago of the interesting images. You know, the child and the blood and the weapons, those are interesting to put together. So I wonder, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, for me anyway, with this sort of book, I have, you know, a lot of really short poems. Poems for me that when I read would take anywhere from 10 to 20, 25, 30 seconds on the average. There's maybe three or four poems that are longer than that, but they mostly fall into the shorter ones. So it was really important for me to sort of get the sequencing and the order right and not just have them be a bunch of short little poems, just, you know, in a book. I had to make them sort of run together in sequences. So things like the title of the book, the way I sectioned them off, and then the first poem, it was important that I sort of, for me anyway, get the first poem right, because then it's just sort of like a thread that would unravel from there. So I wanted to sort of set the stage a bit with the first poem and not lead up to some of maybe the violence or the strangeness of the poem. So yeah, there's a child in a ditch, there's blood and various things, but it also talks about time being chained to the next howling and deep, so I wanted to take it beyond just ordinary sort of violence that one might expect. So it's kind of the violence of time, and it being belonging or being kind of a slave or a victim or a participant or witness or whatever of time itself.
And at the end of that poem, the last line is, "You belong to them." And I thought it was interesting, in a number of the poems in this collection, you address the reader as you. What do you think that accomplishes, or what do you think that does to the reader?
I'm either addressing the reader, if they're reading it, but it's also more of the voice self-addressing, too, at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So that poem's not, addressed to anyone specifically, but it could be the voice talking to itself.
Okay. Oh, I see. So it's not so much an indictment or a...
But there's no way around it. You're right. When I write it that way, you're going to get some of what I've just said, plus the reader's going to read it as though the reader, him or herself, is within the poem. So that's fine with me.
So let's just take a minute and look at that second one that you read. The whale getting roped.
Needle hips in a whale. It's the first poem of the second section, I think.
I'm curious, the image of the whale... to some extent, I'm wondering if these images are experiential, if these are things that come to you after you see something or experience something, or if they just sort of come to you.
I think I know what you're asking, and some of the poems are the minority, I suppose, of poems come from, or the core of them comes from seeing something or experiencing something, and sort of getting that down, and then to a various extent reworking those notes or whatever I've written down. But probably more so, I'm building poems out of feeling emotion and generating the poem rather than waiting for the poem to come to you, to be inspired by a moment. That being said, inspiration is going to come to you when you're working hard, and images that are important to you or that have made an impact on you at whatever point in your life are going to tend to come up more often. I think there's at least in one of the places, there's a whale in the book, about the whale coming out to die, a whale that's sort of beaching itself. It's in, I think, the fourth or fifth section, and it keeps coming back out. There was one or two other whale poems that had a whale in it that may have been in the drafts that I had of the book, and for one reason or another didn't make it in there. So for every image that's used once or twice or even three times in the book, that's probably something I've used, different strategically each time perhaps, but to various extents in many, many other poems that I've written. Uh-huh. Like Monet or Van Gogh might have painted the same scene 5, 10, 20 different times in different light and different times of the year, different times of the day from slightly different angles.
Right.
And then choose what goes into the book. So things, I guess, that I'm obsessed with that are important to me are going to come up again and again, and that can be ideas, feelings, or even images that just seem to be favorites of mine.
Right. Okay. I'm curious if you live on the ocean or near the ocean.
I do. I live a couple blocks from the ocean. I can see a small bit of it, but I don't have an ocean view per se. I live on a river that runs through the middle of downtown Puerto Vallarta here in Mexico.
Oh.
And my main view is the river and then the mountain across from us. So I have a jungle mountain and river view.
Well, that's all very evocative, I would think. You have a lot of sense of place in your poetry, place and that whale is also sort of making me think of the ocean. And so.
Yeah, I mean, I like... Some stuff is because of what's around me or what I see, and then some stuff's what's important to me. There's other, sort of animal or natural images because that's something that's always been important for me. I grew up on 3 acres halfway out into the country when I was little, and we had, you know, 50 or 60 dogs. My parents used to raise them. We had chickens, horses, rabbits, budgies, parrots, all types of animals. So I grew up in that environment, and that's never really left me.
Mm-hmm. So the five sections of this collection are Wounded, Death, In the Shape of a Storm, All Night, Forever, and Holy Land. I'm curious which came first, the poems or the sections?
Most of the poems came first, but then once I started to feel my way into how to write a book, I mean, I knew how to write poems before I knew how to write a book of poems, or a successful manuscript of poems anyway.
Right.
So once the book started taking more shape and I started to understand how the sections would work, and there was a lot of juggling around of how the sections were placed, and even the dropping, you know, drop a section or two and come up with a new one or two to kind of think of them in the shape of five and how that worked together. So as that work came along, some poems did kind of get generated in the book writing process. But most of the material, the raw material of the poems themselves, existed before the book.
Now, did you have to eliminate any poems after they didn't fit in with the structure?
Oh, yeah, tons. I can't emphasize how much, how big a gap there was between having 50 or 60 poems ready in the beginning that I thought would make up a manuscript, in which I got into kind of the first draft, and then working with my publisher slash editor, they were very helpful with me. The book went through four or five major revisions, and out of the first 50 or 60 I had in the book, maybe half of those survived through to the end.
Mm.
And quite a few other ones in the second or third or fourth drafts fell out before the final draft also. It was a lot of work in making the book and a lot of falling out. And just in writing poems, you have to learn to lose phrases, to lose images, to lose certain things in poems to make the poem as good as it can be. It's kind of the same thing with the book. There's some poems that I really like, I think are strong poems, that I wanted to be in the book. I kind of wanted desperately for them to be in there, but just for one reason or another, they didn't seem to fit or to make it, and I kept taking them out. And my judgment got better as I went along that, you know, as much as I wanted something, if it didn't work, it didn't work, and I got to sort of work at it to revise it in a way with a knife after a while, so.
Yeah, so was that must have been hard, but it sounds like you learned from it.
Yeah, no, I did. I learned how to make a book for the first time out of a bunch of poems because, you know, maybe, I don't know, in times gone by, perhaps you could just take your best poems, put them together, and that might be more of a book. But with poetry anyway these days, you have to really thematically organize and it has to work as a book. And for me anyway, that was a good thing. It was a whole new scale to work on and to succeed at, so. You know, I'll have to do it a second time at some point in the future, and that'll be different, but I did learn a lot, yeah.
Do you think you'll recycle any of the ones that you kept back?
Yeah, maybe. probably most of them will be newer stuff. You know, my first impulse after the first book, and I waited a little while, is I sat down to write to do a second one because, you know, I put a lot of hard work into the first one and learned the lessons, so I was like, how hard can it be? And I had a lot of other material. But it just didn't seem to have the life, the energy, and wasn't naturally working out. I tried it a few times, so I abandoned that and just said, okay, I'll just generate new material and figure out the type of stuff I'm writing and just wait and see. So I've written a lot of new material that some of it's been organized into chapbooks, short, you know, 15, 20 poem little chapbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been a little bit easier because you just have essentially one section, pretty much one main thing you're working on. So most of the poems, I think, will be the newer stuff, not old stuff that got cycled out.
Right.
But
right.
Some will make it in for sure, because once I start revising, I might have literally hundreds of poems or fragments in front of me that I'm trying to work with to make it all happen.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the italicized epigraphs at the beginning of each section? Did you write those toward the end of the process, or?
No, those I constantly revised them throughout and, again, juggled them up or dropped them and put new ones in. But pretty early on, once I had it sectioned off in the way that I had it sectioned off, I wanted to have those italicized poems. And I wanted them to be my poems. So many books and so many authors, you see, you know, quotes from other people, which is fair enough, but I didn't want to go that way. And I thought I could write stuff that would be just as appropriate or as much of a frame or mood setter or whatever you want to call, as much of a setup for what followed it. So, they didn't come at the end. They came. They were part of the making and just as important as the poems themselves.
Right. Well, you sort of touched on this a tiny bit, but I just want to get back to it. The way that you have sometimes written about sex and violence and God and combined those themes in your work, that has sometimes been called gratuitous, including by a friend of yours whose comments you posted on your blog. And you responded that you don't think you're trying to shock people. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the difference between your poems and shocky poems. And I know you sort of did touch on this.
Yeah, that's a fine line. I mean, I guess I could say that one of the differences is that I think that mine are good or artful or thoughtful or beautiful. And I believe I have put a lot of work into the poems. And I'm sure I'm crossing the line. I do that. I realize that anyway when I have drafts of poems in front of me that they are probably a bit too gratuitous. I mean, that's like the fine line between the sublime and the ridiculous, so I have that saying goes. But I do believe my poems are not just, you know, penthouse forum moments or articles or narratives. I don't write them for shock value. They may in some points shock a reader. When I read other people's poems that have bad words or violent and or sexual imagery, it's also a little bit shocking to me because I'm a reader, not a writer. Like I said before, you know, I would hope that the reader would give the writing a chance. If they don't, you know, I understand that. That's the way it goes. Certain amount of people won't, and my writing's not for everybody.
Right.
When I write, I would hope that I'd be responsible to make sure the poems have shape and say more, or if they're going to be part of a sequence that, you know, I am working on something that I think is artful, but.
I'm just curious if the intensity of your material ever surprises you as it's being generated, as you're writing a first draft.
You know, as I'm writing it, generally not, because in the moment, you know, a lot of writers describe, you know, you write kind of sometimes within a trance, and you kind of get lost, you know, there's a tunnel or whatever else, and you write. And yeah, my stuff does surprise me later on sometimes, you know, you write and then you do stuff for several other hours or an hour or two or days, and you come back to some of your work and you read it almost as a reader, not as a writer anymore. And then, yeah, it does surprise you or shock you to a little extent or affect you in the way you'd want it to affect somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that, another old saying, and that's about sublime and ridiculous. There's another old saying that people use in workshops or in teaching programs, right? You know, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So I think that's true to a certain extent. And if you can surprise yourself, write something interesting to yourself. Usually for me it's on the second reading, not in the moment. But if you can surprise yourself later on, then there's a good chance that you're going to surprise the reader or some readers out there, and that's a good thing.
There's a poem in this collection, Holy Land. I'm wondering if you can read it for us. It's the poem about the hanged, or the man who's waiting to be hanged.
Oh, right. Yeah, let me see. Okay, yeah. The day he was hanged, my wife and I sat at a bar, bewildered by the speed and beauty of a sushi chef. Everything he does, each wrap, each cut, says we are immortal, especially when he places the mutilated head and torso of a lobster in a bowl of ice, its long feelers tasting the air, and in a small dish its flesh. My wife's hand is hot. I can feel eternity tightening around us. I can feel the bones in it gleaming. In the doorway of his cell, he looked at the guards as though they'd tell him he had a chance, and we walked with him to his death, singing.
That one really struck me. I wonder if you remember what was the inspiration for that poem.
Yeah, that one's fairly straightforward. I don't get too many of these anymore. I'm not writing them this way, but I used to print out a lot of news articles off the Internet on things that just caught my eye or that were interesting, and then I'd just have a stack of 10 or 20 or 30 of them and take fragments out of those and put them in my journal and then, you know, read through those occasionally and then try to piece together or to use those as parts of or the core of poems. So that was one. I think it was in Thailand or Malaysia or, I don't know, some Australian guy who was running drugs got arrested and was hanged. And I remember about the same time I was in Las Vegas with my wife and we went to dinner and we had sushi. So those are the two main components of the poem, I suppose. the last part about, well, I don't know if it's in the poem itself, but I remember thinking about this as I wrote in the poem. I had kind of In the Name of the Father, the movie with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
There's a scene in there, I think, where when the father's died, everybody lights pieces of paper and they drop those out of the windows, and then they start up the music that makes everybody feel sad that they always do in movies. I kind of had that feeling while I was thinking of that as I wrote the poem, as I revised it, especially as the poem reached its final form and its final draft. I don't know, that's not in the poem, really, but I remember feeling or thinking that.
Well, I think sometimes the inspiration for what you write isn't going to be as artful as what you end up writing out of it. And personally, I like the poem better than the movie image, so.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, as long as it's, you know, it's what I felt when I saw those things or read other things, and if I can bring the honesty of the real honesty and reality of the feeling and the emotion, rather, across properly, it doesn't have to be truthful to the facts or anything else like that. It just has to be truthful to the emotion, the effect. I don't ever feel like I need to be faithful to how things happened or to be truthful, because that's not the real truth of things.
Right. Well, it's also like you had said earlier that, you know, you're not necessarily going to talk about what a poem is about, because maybe it's not really about something so much as...
No, that's right. It's certainly what I just said about the poem you asked me to read, that it's not about any of the things I said. Those are just some of the ways that brought me to making the poem.
Right, the inspiration.
The poem's what I read, and it's how it detonates or forms in the reader as the reader reads it. That there's nothing else to it. But
yeah, yeah.
We could talk about other things that might make the reader think of or remind the reader of, or that the writer can talk about in the making of it, but those are incidental and sort of, you know, peripheral issues anyway.
Speaking about your reading the poem, I attended a reading that you did in conjunction with a Black Ocean event in New York, and it seemed that you were having a lot of fun reading your work. You interjected comments and seemed almost like you were maybe changing things as you went. I don't know if that was just my impression. And it was almost as though you looked at the reading as an art form in itself. Is that accurate, or is that not true?
The last thing you said about looking at the reading as an art form, or I do think that. And I practice the readings, sometimes record them, or listen to my iPod to make revisions. I'll practice them. I don't really ad-lib too much, though, so that's maybe something where...
It was just your
style.
You're
a little off, I suppose, because even with the comments in between, I'm not much of a public speaker. And just the idea of even reading was something I had to overcome, the fact I'd never done that before and had anxiety over. But, you know, for me anyway, poetry is supposed to be, you know, read on the page, but it's supposed to be, you know, heard and read well, I think, by the poet himself or herself. So, I work hard on the readings, and mostly the comments or things that go between sections, I do try to write them out almost word for word how I'm going to say them.
Yeah. I know that you're leaving today for a series of readings that you're doing in the Midwest. I'm just curious, how hard is it to arrange to have your work heard and to find venues to read your work?
You know, I think that's getting more and more difficult as time goes by. Just about anything within the writing or the small press world is poetry specifically, because that's what I do. There are more and more writers out there, writers who are coming through programs, who have work, who want to get published in journals. So there are more journals. It's easy to start your own internet journal, and some of them are, you know, pretty well thought of now even. But there still are tons more writers than there are spaces to have things published, as far as individual poems or individual short stories or whatnot. And there's a lot more manuscripts out there, full-length collections, than there are books that can be published. I think there are also a lot more people wanting to read and promote their work, their chapbooks, their full books, than there are reading spots available at good established reading series. So all levels are a little blocked up and becoming more difficult. So just like sending poems out, you have to be organized, and that's a different part of the... If you want to be a writer, you've got to invest a lot of time, effort, and be really persistent in trying to get published, you know, your poems, your stories, your book, in setting up readings. You're going to get a lot of no's. You're going to get a lot of no responses even. Some of these reading series schedule, you know, I've gotten not too many, but I've gotten a few responses which have told me that they schedule 2 years out.
Wow.
Which is just unfathomable to me, but yeah, it's true. And then some are more casual and don't do as often. The good thing is about having, I've read a lot now already, is that you meet people at readings and that leads you to other readings and you develop, become more a part of the community, and that helps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, just by publishing, it's extremely difficult, and a lot of good writers, a lot of good writing gets, they're lost in the shuffle and they get ground out and they don't persist, and that's, that's unfortunate, but that's part of the system.
Yeah. The comment that you just made about how everything's getting a little bit more difficult, a little more blocked up, reminds me that I was looking at your chapbook, Ringing, that you published through Kitchen Press,
mm-hmm.
and I really liked the format online. So I want to talk about both online publishing as well as that particular book or chapbook, Ringing. So first of all, let's just talk about Ringing a little bit. On that website, you can see an illustrated or a text-only version, and I liked that. You can choose what you want to look at.
Right, and there's a download. You can do a PDF version that you can print also.
And you're actually seeming to turn pages when you're on the website. You can kind of see the pages turning. It's sort of more of a sensory reading experience.
Yeah, and if you have the volume on it, you get the sound of the pages turning, which
oh.
for some people is annoying. You can switch it off. It makes a loud sound of a page turning.
Oh, I don't think I noticed that. That's fun.
Those
are your illustrations, right?
Yeah, those are my illustrations. a few of them I'm proud of. The rest are, just what I came up with. And they're kind of bright colors, and I thought the overall look kind of went together, especially, like you said, the illustrated version has my handwriting, which, in some places is not sort of legible, really. But within the reader has a chance to go back to the text version, if they want to read them properly without problems.
Now, we should probably say what the website is. Do you know that off the top of your head?
Yeah, it's just my name with Ringing at the end of it. So it's just RowanKlasnikRinging.com.
Okay. And Rowan is R-A-U-A-N.
RAUANKLASNIK, and then Ringing.
Okay. So how did you approach Kitchen Press?
Well, I know Justin. I met him after one of my readings, actually. The same one you referred to earlier when the book launched at AWP New York in February 2008. I met him there, and I liked his writing, and he was at the reading too. So we ended up reading a few places together in Brooklyn later in the year, and in Boston also. I mean, that's the sort of networking that I talked about before, is once you get the ball rolling a bit as far as readings or other things, you will meet people that you like and that are doing the same sort of things you are, and one thing does lead to another. So that's the good thing about once things get started. So once I had pretty much what I thought was a manuscript ready, a chapbook, and I didn't want my second release to be a full-length book, I talked to him about it, and I wanted it to be online, for sure, because as much as there are lots of chapbooks out there that are pretty and that are really nice, and a lot of people really prefer and love, and I love them too, books that you can hold and see and touch, that's great. The writing was on the wall, I think, kind of, that not too many people read those chapbooks. You have to convince or make people aware of even that they're available, and then you have to get them to buy it. They have to pay, send off, use PayPal, credit card, whatever. It's a lot easier to get somebody to just go to a website where it's free to look at the work. Now, the work's still the work, so if it's not good or people don't like it, that's still the way it's going to work out. But just with the Internet, having an e-chapbook, an electronic chapbook, I thought that more people would read it.
Mm-hmm.
And you still have to work. You have to make people go there and read it to a certain extent.
Yeah, having people read it is sort of the point, isn't it? Because you're not going to probably make your first million on your poetry. Maybe you will. But
yeah, no, really not. You want people to read the stuff and to respond to it, and either like it or not like it, but most importantly, to read it. The most writers, I'm sure, the big concern you have is when you publish a book in hard copy form or in e-form, is that you don't want it to sort of be ignored, to just sort of fizzle away.
Right.
You'd rather things good and bad be said. You don't want just bad things to be said, but you take the good with the bad with the good, rather, just because you want it to get out there and you want it to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people say, oh, well, I'm just writing for myself, and if my stuff doesn't get famous while I'm alive, I think that's just, for the most part, just garbage. Most people want their stuff to do to be read and to do well.
Right. Do you want to read a couple more selections, maybe either from Holy Land or from something else?
I'll read a couple poems from Ringing.
Okay.
Like ships leaning together, licking each other's shoulders, we fall down and dig at the earth, fervently, like jackals. Fire is leaping from hill to hill, and my nerves are swaying like seaweed. I have learned to die, and not to. My veins are filled with milk. And then a second one from Ringing.
Mm-hmm.
A truck filled with cattle's overturning. It goes down on its side, sliding. All you can see is silver, like music, as you walk among them, as you touch their heads, as you go down through the pine trees, kicking a rock in the bright light, whistling.
Hmm. Okay, so I know I'm not supposed to, but I have to ask if you saw a cattle car overturn.
No, I never saw a cattle car overturn, but I do remember, you know, kind of where that poem started, or the seed for it, I suppose. Not, you know. I read the book, The Road, Cormac McCarthy's.
Oh, right.
Yeah, which I didn't really like at all, and it was unfortunate because it was my first McCarthy book, and only one so far, but I you know, some authors, you know, their career progresses, and if you read the correct, there's a good book to read first, and if, you know, or some books are better to read first, and it gives you the right impression, but you read the wrong book, and it can turn you off a little bit. So that book was coming like that. But there were some images or things in that book that stayed with me, or that I jotted notes down for, or that later on, you know, meant something to me or helped me with a poem. And so I suppose in that way that book, even though I thought it was weak, you know, helped me out, I suppose.
Now, The Road, that was his post-apocalyptic novel.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's just with Father and the Son sort of walking along for 150 pages.
Yeah. There's a posting on your blog about some, I think they're new poems, called All the Messiahs.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to just read a little section from your blog. All the Messiahs is a sequence of about 18 poems I wrote while in Vienna, Rome, and Sicily this past January. I lived with these poems for weeks and didn't use other notes to supplement, augment, distort, blah, blah. No iPod. It felt good, and I liked the poems. I found this interesting, particularly the iPod comment, because I sometimes feel like all the technology we now have offers us the ability to distract ourselves in a way that's really not very good for our writing. And I was curious if that was at all what you were getting at with the iPod comment.
Actually, that's not what I meant, because I use my iPod for generating content.
Oh.
So kind of the opposite of what you mean. My iPod's like my steroids version of using other content. The sentences you read before that of the blog post about not using other notes to augment, distort, blah blah.
Right.
You know, so when I build poems, I'll refer back to other notes to other journals or stuff I've written from years ago, even to bring in phrases or images or just give me more options. Like have more, a painter might have more color in front of them, different colors from which to work with. I usually have tons of notes that even when I travel, I take with me, and then use those as bits of material that I can use as necessary or to help generate. So I use the iPod in the same way because I use it from songs themselves, but then when I read stuff, when I need a novel, I may circle 50 or 60 sections, 10, 20, 30 second little splotches that I'll record onto my computer into MP3 files and then create playlists with those sections on my iPod. So I have probably three or four times as many of those little sound bites than I do actually have songs. So if I just do a straight shuffle off all my files, it brings up a lot of those little excerpts from other people's work, which, you know, I'll just, and they may suggest something to your ride, or I'll just change the words up and put those down and then build poems out of those pieces or use those pieces to fill in or to augment, distort, whatever, my other stuff. So I wasn't using my iPod to change the poems or to rework them in any way. I just worked with the poems and any notes I made during those few weeks that I was with. I just had the one notebook full of notes in the poems themselves, which was a little different than the more aggressive poem-making processes that I was using otherwise.
Oh, okay. So it was sort of a simpler approach to just these particular poems.
Yeah, it's simpler. I suppose that's a good way to say it. And it felt good to work in that way. I was really immersed in just these poems. and the bits and pieces that surrounded them directly.
Okay. I'm curious, who might your influences be?
I've been asked this question before, and the way I've usually answered is to sort of go back to kind of the beginning when I started to write, or when writing or poetry first was kind of important to me. And I remember in the beginning, I think my dad had, and this is still as a teenager, I wasn't a person who wrote at a really early age, but at 15, 16, I guess I began to write in a kind of serious way. And Dylan Thomas's poems and recordings, my dad had an LP of Dylan Thomas reading, and that the sound of the poetry itself and the grandeur of it even was really impressive to a young person just sort of figuring out, you know, in being initiated into writing and into life itself, really, that poetry was really important to me. And then other British poets, it was strange that, you know, I went to high school in Dallas, Texas, but the poets that I read most in high school and in college were poets like Ted Hughes, Sylvia Plath's husband, who, besides being hated for his involvement in her life, I think has wrote many great books of poetry, and they have a violence and sadness also to it that attracted me. There's a bunch of crow poems where there's a crow figure that's kind of a, like the creation that a lot of indigenous people have, that the crow figure is a central player in those stories or those creations. That's the crow is an important figure in Hughes's poetry and in the book he wrote called Crow. So books like that were really important to me. Seamus Heaney, Paul Muldoon are a couple of Irish poets whose language appealed to me. Later on, when I wrote prose poetry like Charles Simic, or French prose poets like Max Jacob or Jean Follain, Gary Young's an American poet who lives on the West Coast, who's a generation or two older than me. But I read a book of his that had a bunch of really short prose poems, and in some ways felt like, you know, haiku almost. And those were models when I started writing prose poems for me, the French prose poets, maybe some at Gary Young.
Okay.
Later on, Rumi, Hebrew-Spanish poets of a little bit after his time period, the kind of, you know, God and the Beloved poetry really appealed to me because that's some of the types of poems I'm trying to write or do write anyway.
Uh-huh.
And then haiku itself, I'm not a well-studied haiku, but the essential haiku that Haas put out, that's the three big names, Basha, Isen, Busson, was a book that I really enjoyed and, you know, probably had something of an influence on me.
Okay. What are you reading now?
I'm reading a couple of books. I'm reading a book called Europeana. It's a book written it's a contemporary book written by a guy who moved from Prague, I think, to Paris. And he's a poet too, I think. It's a really strange book that just is written like it's hundreds of years in the future, but it's like a brief history of the 20th century where it just talks about all the kind of bad things that happened in the 20th century. Mostly bad things. And it's written in a really flat style, but it begins like by talking about the tallest soldiers in World War II were the American soldiers, and this is how tall they were. And if you put them head to toe, this is how the number that died at the Normandy invasion would stretch this many kilometers. And then he tells you how many kilometers the other dead would have stretched. And certain Senegalese warriors were a little bit taller, so the Allies put them in the front lines to scare the Germans. And he just goes on and on and on with. It's only 120, 130 page book, but it's unbelievable as to how many things it brings up or how strange and laughable people become when you look at them kind of with that sort of objectivity. Like I said, it looks like it's written in a history book that's 300-400 years from now.
Wow.
Just sort of talking about what happened and how crazy people were with war and religion and whatnot and government, etc.
Yeah.
The other one I'm reading is it's a book called The Book of Frank. It's by a Philadelphia poet. His name is C.A. Conrad. He wrote most of the stuff in the early 90s, but the book's just been published now, and I met him at a reading in Philadelphia, and I'm interviewing him. I'm going to start soon on that book. I don't know if you saw on my blog, but I've done a series of interviews with authors about their books.
Right.
I've done 6 or 7 so far, and I've got another 3 or 4 lined up.
What about what you're writing? What are you working on now?
I think I touched on this a little bit before about the fact that, you know, after finishing the first book, I kind of had the, oh, wow, I can write a second one. I figured out how to do it. So I tried that a few times. You know, over the first several months after the first book, I sat down, and from anywhere from a week to 2 or 3 weeks, I tried and built sections and put poems together that would make up a second book. But I fairly quickly, anyway, figured out that it just wasn't kind of working. There wasn't the right sort of energy, or I just didn't have it together, the material, the feel for what the book would be, even, or anything like that. So I just started to concentrate on writing and generating new poems.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly different ways of generating the material, perhaps, but just to build a backlog of poems from which I could eventually build a second manuscript. And I haven't sat down to work on it yet, but I've had better thoughts or feel for how that book could be or will be. You know, that may or may not pan out the way I'm thinking now, but I'm getting, you know, stronger feelings about how that book can work.
Mm-hmm.
And then I built the chapbook that you saw ringing that went
online.
It was a smaller project where the poems are, you know, pretty much in the same vein, and that might end up being in a different form anyway, maybe be a section of a second book. And I've got another chapbook coming out in the summer called Dreaming, which are poems that are either transcripts of dreams or incorporate dream elements or fabricated dream sort of worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And those have, for the most part, a really different feel than Holy Land or the Ringing chapbook poems. So I got that coming up. And the All the Messiahs, those new poems you referenced on my blog, that's a manuscript-length collection, 18 or 20 poems that I may decide to publish as a chapbook, or I'll just scrap it and take bits and pieces and use them later for the full-length manuscript.
Uh-huh. Well, I have one more question for you. For writers who might be listening, do you have any suggestions for what they might do when they get stuck in their work, or what you do when you have a little writer's block?
I think I mentioned something briefly before about, you know, a lot of writers having pretty rigid routines as far as, like, write the same time every day, same place.
Right.
And I think that's good, because you need discipline to force you to do stuff, just like, you know, going to the gym to work out. You know, if you're going to do it 3-4 days a week, or if you have a trainer even, or you have a workout partner, and you have commitments, and it's good because it keeps you rolling, just like people in writing programs, MFA or graduate or whatever else. It's good because you're forced to sit down and write or think critically or whatnot a lot versus making yourself do it. So that's all good and well. But for me also, you know, it's good that I travel, let's say, and that gets me to different places and gets me a little on edge or shakes things up a little bit. That always helps. But, you know, if you can't just sort of drop of the hat or traveling anywhere, you can sort of travel or break your own routine. I mean, even when I'm at home for extended periods of time, just going to the supermarket with my wife or going down into the plaza and sitting around watching the pigeons and kids chasing balloons around, whatever, can help me get out of a rut. You know, you take your journal everywhere and force yourself outside of some of those routines anyway, I think is pretty helpful.
Mm, that's good advice. So take yourself out of your normal daily life, even if it's close by.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the inner world is, you know, is so flexible and fine, it's so easy for it to get in a rut. And I think that's what's happening when people get stuck, is that you're breaking down yourself.
Yeah.
The work or the block, it's about you. So, you know, you can travel to an exotic place a long way, but you can sit in a different part of the house or go in the backyard.
Yeah.
Or in the park that's across the street or something that's really close, or get on a train or a bus or something.
That's a good,
yeah. Just take your journal with you. On the other side of the coin there, some people do need the routine. Some people just wait for inspiration to come along, and they're perpetually in the moving around, you know, waiting for it to happen. Those people need to build those couple hours a day or an hour a day or whatever it is to sit in the same place and to force themselves to write, to get ideas on the page.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you very much for talking with me today.
No, it's been my pleasure.
That was an interview with Rowan Klosnick. Next week, please tune in again to hear a conversation with Vermont novelist and essayist Castle Freeman, Jr. Right, the book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or at 802-985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Rowan Klosnick. Rowan uses an iPod to shuffle his own thoughts, recorded audio files, as well as excerpts from television and radio in order to generate ideas for his poetry. If you don't have an iPod or prefer to work on paper, follow the exercise as Rowan explained it to me. Turn on your radio or TV. As you hear a song or conversation, randomly write down either a snippet of what you hear or what it brings to mind. If you write down someone else's actual words, change the phrase later or put it in quotes in your poem. Now change the channel and do the same thing again. Do this 6 or 7 or maybe even 10 times until you've filled a page of paper. Then do that same thing 3 or 4 or 5 times over, writing in blocks of text until you have several pages. After that, you can rework those blocks, juggle the order of words and thoughts and phrases, change things, add things. When you need a change, skip to the second page and start doing it there. Work in batches. You can work with sound files and an iPod set to shuffle if you know how to use that technology to help you, but it's not necessary. The exercise works just fine on the computer using cut and paste or with old-fashioned paper and pen. This won't necessarily result in a finished poem, probably. Probably it'll need a lot of work, but it's a useful exercise for generating ideas and getting started. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can once again stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. As always, archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. This is probably a good time to mention that the views expressed on Write the Book are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WOMMLP, its management board, or any of its affiliates. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby is up at 3 o'clock with The World of Music. This has been Write the Book. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.